You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We're coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is July 7th, 2022. I hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. Let's dive into it. Bhavin, first of all, I hope your holiday was nice. Yeah, I suppose you had Monday off and hopefully you did something fun.
Yeah, so originally, things had to change, but originally my plan was to hit up Acadia National Park and do some camping and hiking. But I sprained my ankle on Thursday and basically there was no point in traveling and because I would have just been sitting at the campfire and doing nothing. So yeah, the plans changed last minute. I just stayed home. We had some friends over, had a good time, made some food. That's it.
Great. Hopefully staying cool. I know you were working out your air conditioning situation.
Yeah, we did get while we were waiting for contractors and mini splits to be installed, we did get a portable AC thing. So not a window AC, but a portable one, which covers enough of the living room that it keeps the house cool. So it worked out.
Luckily, we haven't had any terribly 90. Of course, I'll say this now and talking to you.
So you're going to jinx it, Ryan.
Nice.
Yeah. How about you? How was your fourth?
Yeah, no, it was good. I spent the week prior in Shenandoah, as you know, which was really nice. And then, like you, stayed around for the actual holiday at the house. We had a bunch of friends over. Didn't do fireworks or anything, but we have a pool this year, so we spent pretty much the entire day in there, which was great. Always a good time. I had a fire and s'mores at the end of the day, which the kids always love, so can't complain.
That's awesome. Yeah, typical 4th of July weekend, I guess.
Yeah, right. I didn't have any hot dogs, so I don't know, maybe I wasn't truly doing it right, but cool. Well, we have a really cool guest lined up for today. Matthew Larey. We'll introduce him in a bit, but we're going to talk all about SpeedScale and what it is and what it does. He's been in the industry for the past 20 years, improving performance and of applications across multiple generations of technology. He's currently the co-founder and CTO of SpeedScale, so I'm sure we'll learn a lot from Matt later on the show. But before we get into that, let's dive into the recent news we have here.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, so from a news perspective, I know security was is kind of the focus for now, for at least in the Kubernetes ecosystem. An article came online which used a clickbait number, 900,000 Kubernetes instances found exposed online. And I was like, okay. First of all, I was happy that there are close to 1 million Kubernetes clusters running in the wild. But if you read through the article, you will see that the 900,000 number is just a number. If you break it down, 5,000 of those give you a request is unauthorized, which means that there is a cluster there. If you dive into it even further, only 799 Kubernetes instances actually returned a status code 200, which means they can be vulnerable to external attacks. So 900,000 and then just $7.99. Like, it feels weird and like clickbaity, but if somebody would have published like, oh, $7.99 Kubernetes clusters are vulnerable, nobody would have clicked on the link. So yeah, this at least raises some security standards.
I know. I had the same reaction. I know we saw this article separately, and we were like, we both had the same reaction. I was like, wow, that was a lot. But actually, nothing that bad is there happening. Or like, you know, having 443 on the internet, you're like, okay, that's totally normal. Although there are some examples in that article that, you know, showcase that there are some out there that totally just expose, you know, no authentication. I can kind of go into it. So definitely not good when you do that, but agreed. There is a lot though. I think having, you know, over 900 or 1 million, I think I saw a lot of clusters in the wild.
Okay, so following along the security topic, right? Trivi from Aqua Security. Trivi is like their open source scanner tool. It came out with a new release, the 0.29.0 release. And it added a few details like that. Again, they added a bunch of features. I would talk about like two or three. So the first thing they added is just a way to look at your RBAC permissions. So RBAC allows you, role-based access control, allows you to define your user privileges and who gets access rights and who's allowed to like access, use, modify, or delete resources. And then when you're doing RBAC in Kubernetes, you are doing it through roles and cluster roles and service accounts and stuff like that. If you're running in production, you might have multiple of these without a single way to look at what these are and what resources they have access to. So now, using the Trivi UI, you can actually look at all the different RBAC roles, what resources they have access to. So a neat way to like figure out like what exists in your own cluster.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then Trivi like supports infrastructure as code. So if you have CloudFormation templates or if you have Pulumi, I don't know what they call it, templates, maybe something else. But if you have all of those, Trivi can scan those for you, scan those config files and represent or highlight the misconfigurations. They expanded that support to include Helm charts as well. So if you're building Helm charts to deploy resources on Kubernetes clusters, Trivi can now scan them, give you reports on like what's wrong, what should be fixed and stuff like that. And then the last thing they added is support for containerd-based containers. So now they can scan those container images or container workloads as well.
Yeah, the scanning of the Helm charts is, I think, something that caught my eye as something so useful, right? I think a lot of us, especially getting into Kubernetes or whether we're designing Kubernetes, using it day to day, we use Helm, right? And we often use it blindly, right? So I think this is a tool that I immediately was like, this is great, you know, being able to just hand over a config and say, you know, tell me some information about it that, you know, is it good to go? Is it, you know, is there a glaring defect? Mm-hmm. Big security flaws. I really like that.
Best thing is it's open source, right? There is really no reason why you shouldn't be doing all of this already. So if you're listening to this, try out Trivi. Okay, next let's focus to, I have a couple of additional pillars, but let's focus to storage for a while. So KubeFS, it's an open source software-defined Kubernetes distributed storage platform. I think in end of 2019, it became a CNCF sandbox project. And then last week it came out that it has now been upgraded, and from a sandbox state it now is a CNCF incubating project. So it delivers that cloud native distributed storage compatible with S3, POSIX or HDFS as the protocols. And then like if you look at the companies that contribute to it, there are more than I think 90 developers actively working on it. JD.com, Oppo are some of the vendors that are involved in maintaining this project. So if you're looking for an open source alternative for a storage system, KubeFS might be one.
Yeah, and for those listening, Cube is spelled with a C in this case. Mm-hmm.
They went the other way. Like, okay, let's not be obvious.
I think, you know, being a cloud native distributed storage, maybe they were going with the C for a while, you know, but
okay.
So unless you're just researching and like, I can't KubeFS with a K. Moving on.
Nice. Talking about storage, right? On that, our storage OS, or they were previously known as storage OS, released their new version called 2.8. They added three new features, support for full snapshots on demand. So now you have persistent volumes running on that. You can take snapshots and offload them to an S3 repository. to run on that, they do require like an etcd cluster. So before this release, they needed like an external etcd instance. Now that's you can check a box, or you can select running etcd inside your Kubernetes cluster itself. So that's an option. And then they added support for monitoring using Prometheus and Grafana. So now they have dashboards that you can integrate into your existing Prometheus and Grafana instances and use that to monitor your ONDAT volumes.
Absolutely. And I know snapshots are long awaited in the ONDAT community. So this is a really exciting release for them. So kudos.
Yeah. And then the final pillar is around just orchestration or Kubernetes distributions. EKS, everybody knows what EKS is. Last year, or I think maybe more than that, they announced EKS Anywhere at reInvent. And the first phase of EKS Anywhere was running EKS Anywhere on top of VMware vSphere, on top of virtual machines. And that was a fully supported version. Last week, they came out with the second phase, which was the EKS Anywhere running on bare metal nodes. So now you can have those physical servers. They do have some prereqs in terms of the amount of CPU memory and storage and a special NIC card that they need, or not special NIC card, but at least it should be able to pixie boot. If you meet those requirements on a per server basis, you can create an EKS Anywhere cluster on your bare metal nodes, connect it back to your AWS console, and use that for running your containerized apps on-prem. They do use some open source projects. So like I've personally played with the virtual machine-based EKS Anywhere. So the deployment workflow is kind of similar. You have an admin workstation. You point it to your bare metal node. So you have to create a hardware inventory file and a cluster file, a cluster configuration file. And it relies on open source projects like Tinkerbell and Kind for server provisioning and bootstrapping, respectively. And then uses Cluster API for lifecycle management for your Kubernetes master and worker node. So for people who were excited about EKS Anywhere, but didn't really want to run it on VMs, this is a great alternative.
Yeah, agreed. And I think a lot of people may be looking at something like EKS Anywhere in the sort of on-prem bare metal space. So it working well in this environment is key, I think, and some of their minimums, right, that they say just a single server only needs 4 CPU, 8 gig of RAM, storage is very attainable, right? Mm-hmm. So that's exciting for sure.
Yeah, and this completes their portfolio, right? Now you have EKS in the cloud, EKS on AWS Outposts, EKS Anywhere on VM, and EKS Anywhere on bare metal node. So pretty much everything is covered if you want to use that EKS distribution in any of your data center or public cloud sites.
Absolutely.
I guess that's it for news for me. We can jump into the speed scale section.
Yes, let's get Matthew on the show. Great to have you here, Matt. Welcome to Kubernetes Bytes. Let's just jump right into it and tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, so my name is Matt LeRae. I am co-founder and CTO of SpeedScale, an Atlanta-based startup. And what being co-founder and CTO means is basically I do a little bit of everything. And so like anytime the engineers, they write like too high a quality code, I'll go in and I'll add some stuff to help kind of keep the quality down and keep them on their toes a little bit. but that's a lot of what I do is a lot of what I do is write our core product and then work on interface with customers to make good product decisions.
Great. That's I think, myself, I'm very new to SpeedScale. I know we had a brief conversation before this podcast, but I think as a great first question is, what is SpeedScale and what problems does it really help solve?
Yeah, so SpeedScale is a shift left API testing platform. And it's very different from normal testing in that we use a concept called traffic replay. So in essence, I have a passionate hatred of writing test cases. I have a passionate hatred of testing my code, mainly because it shows up that I don't write very good code, but also because it's tedious, it takes forever, and it's always wrong. Mm-hmm. So any test cases you write today, just wait 2 weeks and they'll be out of date, and you're going to go back and have to mess with them. But in addition to that, very few engineers are good at guessing what real users will do, even at the API level. And so SpeedScale says, let's turn that problem on its head. Let's record what happens in actual production environments. Mm-hmm. Let's see what people do. And then we will go and reproduce that into what we call an isolation test. So we'll go in, we monitor a real service. We just watch it kind of passively. It works a lot like the way that a service mesh works, like Istio. Sure. Mm-hmm. Where we'll go on Process or Envoy, and we'll go and we'll get a copy of the traffic. Then we will go and create a set of air quotes test cases, right? That'll actually be what real users did. That, and then we'll drive load into the application using that. But then the other magic trick is we'll remove the need for an integration test environment by also simulating the downstream dependencies. So it works because it's what happened in real life. And so, you know, we have all the answers because we saw, if you have like an API, like a, let's say called the Gmail API, we know what Gmail actually said. And so we can reproduce and auto mock all of those third party and internal APIs. So that's in a nutshell.
Got it. Now, you know, some people like myself, I'll call that out right now. What does the term shift left mean?
Well, I mean, if you're talking to a marketing person or engineering person or a little
give me both answers. I'm good with that.
So I think in broad terms, what it means is it means taking production and moving the engineer and moving the production environment onto the engineer's desktop. Mm-hmm. Or another way of thinking of it is giving the engineer magical superpowers to go and be able to recreate production and actually sit in the production system instead of having to guess what's actually happening.
Got it. I like magical superpowers. It's a better answer.
Well, it saves me from a lot of technical questions on how it actually works. That's the whole idea. So, you know, everybody, you see over the last, you know, some odd years, we've been trying to evolve the way that we support production systems because we're trying to get, you see concepts like DevOps. Now you're seeing a further iteration of that concept, you know, site reliability engineers or SREs. Yeah. And a lot of what that's doing is it's trying to bring that automation and creative production or problem solving mindset, you know, into, you know, the production environment. Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the best ways to do that is just to get the developers in there. But everyone hates being on call. So it's actually better to shift it left instead of pushing everyone right.
No, that's awesome, right? Because till this point, whenever we have heard shift left, it has been around security best practices and making sure that you write good code and push that to production rather than having to secure everything in production. So API testing also having to follow the similar path, it's actually great. Yeah.
Agreed. And I think, you know, having, like you said, the exact traffic captured from real environments and be able to recreate it is obviously key to this whole thing. And one thing I have a question about is, you know, you're capturing traffic. How does that actually work? So is it passive in the sense that it doesn't affect any sort of performance of the network? Like, how are you actually capturing that traffic?
So there's a number of different ways. The way we like to think about it is that traffic capture has existed for many, many years. And so we're not going to hang our hat on just the ability to capture at a technical level. Yep. So we have excellent techniques. Like one of the most common ways is folks will install our sidecar proxy. Mm-hmm. So if you're familiar with Kubernetes, you're familiar with the concept of a sidecar, which basically means a container that rides on top of your application container. Sure. And it can do various things. One of the things it can do is it can reroute traffic into a proxy and then reroute it the other side. And so that's probably the simplest way that we work. Now, in addition to that, we also work with things like Istio. Mm-hmm. If you happen to have a service mesh, we'll go ahead and we'll plug into that and let it do some of the work. So we'll do it that way. And then we're even getting into more creative things like there's a bunch of eBPF technologies, one of which is called Pixie, where they actually can capture payloads. Yep. That's a free open source project, like a monitoring tool. And so, you know, we'll go grab it from there if you want. So we'll take it from anywhere you can give it. We actually have customers that do direct CSV uploads, which I do not recommend, but they do it because that's the only way we can get it out.
flexibility is always a good thing for the most part. Maybe not when you're getting giant dumps of CSVs, but I'll leave that to you, I guess.
No, I know we started with the second question about like what SpeedScale is and what it does. Before we get into more technical details, I wanted to like talk about, I was looking up SpeedScale and I saw that you guys were part of Y Combinator and I think batch 20 or something like that. Can you talk more about like that experience, how that was? I know it was in the middle of the pandemic and I know Y Combinator has shifted to this remote model as well.
Yeah, I believe we were actually the first Y Combinator remote class.
Nice.
And so, the thing I like to say, I'll talk about my personal experience with Y Combinator. The first thing is there's a reason why it's one of the most sought after, incubators on the planet. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why, and you can see it when you go through it with them. The expertise available to you is amazing. The folks that are just have done it before, right? They've seen it 100 times. When you give your pitch, they're like, yeah, okay, sure. You know, like they've seen this 100 times, right? And it's useful to have that. It's like having someone who's got 1,000 years of startup experience that they can help you with. And then I say another really positive thing for us was Y Combinator Demo Day drives a sort of like bidding function with venture capitalists, and that can be helpful for those that are financially minded. Now, as far as the thing I'd say that was kind of interesting was that Y Combinator, we were their first remote class, and I think they were still trying to figure out how to balance, you know, part of that in-person magic that you get mm-hmm. from getting all these startup founders in the same building. Obviously, we couldn't do that and still give us enough help and like finding the right balance of providing help without like being redundant or taking up time. Mm-hmm. And so I think that they probably further evolved that and figured out the right pattern. But you know, highly recommend it. Obviously, it's expensive from an equity standpoint, but it can be worth it. So
nice. Awesome. So yeah, we'll keep an eye out for, I know looking at Crunchbase, Speedscale did have like the seed funding rounds. So we'll keep an eye out and maybe we can share some news whenever you guys raise your next round.
Yeah. Well, I love that. And we're optimistic and so
let's go. Okay. So now let's switch gears and let's talk about Kubernetes, right? Since this is Kubernetes Byte. So you already spoke about like how Speedscale works with sidecar containers, but then just from a higher level perspective, and then maybe we can dive deeper. How does Kubernetes and Speedscale work together? How can users like implement it for their applications?
Yeah. So we're, I'm gonna expand your question a little bit. I apologize, but it's relevant. So we were born on Kubernetes. We were born in the cloud. You know, we intentionally built the company around these ideas. So at a technical level, we already talked about sidecars and traffic capture, you know, working with any of the cool Kubernetes ways of doing that from eBPF or proxies or whatever. Now, what happens from there is we start streaming traffic out of a service, right? Then we have an operator. If you're familiar with Kubernetes operators, it's like a sysadmin in a box, right? They're like this genius level person who knows how to run just one thing in the cluster. So Speedscale has an operator for that, and we do some pretty clever things, or at least I think they're clever. Is that we go through and say, hey, that you tag that workload with an annotation, which is like a text string you can put on a workload. You tag that workload. That means we're supposed to test it. So what we'll do is when that workload comes in, we'll freeze it for a second. We will stand up an automatic mocking server. We will stand up a load generator. Then we will rewire the network. We'll do some other things to sort of tune the workload. And then we will run a full load test. And then when we're done, we'll unwrap everything we did and put it back in place just as it was. Mm-hmm. So we do that using Kubernetes operators. That kind of magic. Now our technology does work outside of Kubernetes, but it takes a lot more work.
No, operators do make things easier. So as part of that, right? Like since this is still in the development phase, people are still writing code. Can we integrate with something like Jenkins, JenkinsX, or any other CI/CD tools, right?
Yeah. So our happiest customers use this as part of their CI pipeline.
Got it.
So there's a lot of use cases for traffic replay, but I'll give it the two most common ones, which is folks use us to as mocking servers to actually develop code against. So they'll say, I cannot stand up, you know, 50 microservices in a production environment. So I'm going to instead, you know, have my, I'm gonna actually bring it back to the desktop because you can, you know, if you have like Minikube or even Docker, you can go and run our mocking server and you'll get kind of a continuously updated stream of what a production mock looks like. The second thing and the happiest customers for us are the ones that put us in their CI pipeline. Mm-hmm. So kind of a model for that is you say, every hour, we're going to grab the latest and greatest snapshot, right? And then, you know, and that's continuously update that traffic.
Yep.
And then the CI system, every time somebody does an MR, right? It's almost like a virtual environment. We'll do an MR. We'll run a full battery of tests against it. The simple stuff that everybody expects is like functional tests. We'll make sure there wasn't like an API contract drift, but then we'll do an actual load test because remember, we understand what the traffic actually means. So we can go and, you know, make it look like a lot more users and a lot more other stuff going on. And then we'll do a third thing, which is we'll introduce chaos. So those who love chaos engineering, we do not compete with like infrastructure chaos engineering. What we do instead is it's application level chaos engineering. So we'll actually slow down individual transactions. We'll say, hey, give every once in a while, throw a 500. Like we'll do stuff like that, you know? And just to keep you on your toes and make you enjoy your life. So
yeah, make sure your API requests or responses don't get timed out and stuff like that. So no, that's
easy. You can test retry loops, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Makes sense. You know, I think in Kubernetes, we often talk about a lot of complexity, things like operators doing a lot of things for us. I think maybe an interesting question that I just thought about when you were answering the last one was, you know, let's take a step back and say, you know, how does API testing differ from other types of testing, such as, you know, unit and other types of testing. And what was
in school?
Yeah, what were people doing before, you know, they were coming to, you know, SpeedScale? What makes that transition so worth it, I guess? And you've mentioned you hated certain types of tests, so maybe you have some personal experience here.
I do write unit tests. I like unit tests, but so. Actually, there's a second question in there we'll come back to, but which I think is interesting. But the so unit tests, you should still write unit tests. Unit tests help you understand whether a particular function or, you know, like base level code item works properly. And of course, people should write unit tests. They're the foundation building blocks. Okay. Now, what we challenge is folks who go down one of two paths. The first one is they test every test and prod. Everything's test and prod. Mm-hmm. Now, test and prod obviously is a useful thing to do. Canary releases are obviously useful. Mm-hmm. However, I believe they're being misused. Test and prod is being misused. People are pushing things to prod, and what they're really saying is, let your end users be your crash test dummies. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge mistake. And so, so test and prod is good in small, you know, is good in moderate doses, right? Mm-hmm. So SpeedScale is an alternative to letting your users test your software for you. Got it. The second path people go down to, and this is for folks who have, or applications that are a little bit older or, you know, kind of been around a while, is they'll do things like integration tests or manual testing. Mm-hmm. And first off, manual testing is just terrible and no one should be subjected to it. It's horrible. It's a terrible experience, right, to manual test. Obviously, you have to manual test a little bit, but SpeedScale helps get rid of that because effectively you have thousands and thousands of real manual testers that you don't have to pay, mm-hmm. right? And that's that piece. And the second thing is, you can reduce your dependence on integration testing because SpeedScale is simulating the entire environment. So you can actually, instead of treating the testing problem as everything all at once, instead it's like we can test a component like we integration test because all those mocks are auto-generated. It's reacting, the surrounding environment is acting like a real environment. Sure. And so we kind of, we help you eliminate some of that integration test as well.
Got it. And the obvious one that I think I'm hearing is auto generation of those mocks. You don't have to go write those either, right? So, I mean, I know that was a way to do it in the past as well. You write a whole mock, separate application to mock your whole environment. You add a new API, you got to add a new mock, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, normally you wouldn't do it. What you do is you give it to the new engineer that you don't like. that they would go do that.
Got it.
Conceptually, though, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, makes sense.
Like this really makes sense because of the application architectures that the way they are evolving, right? Now everything is API based. All the different, like loosely coupled distributed application architectures rely on these APIs to work, and all different components should be able to talk to each other. So this like fits in perfectly, right? Like, you, since your application is following this modern architecture, maybe 12 factor, you need something that fits this use case.
Mm-hmm. There's actually an important thing you said as well around automation. You know, something I don't actually know. I tried to find out who said it originally, but I think I heard it when Kelsey Hightower said it, which is that, you know, treat your servers like cattle, not pets.
Yeah.
And I actually think that we're taking a similar philosophy to the way you do testing. So I think that, you know, people should stop treating these tests as these very carefully curated, lovable things, and instead just say, you know what, just blow it all away, replace it with a new version, you know, show me what that looks like, right? And that's the kind of automation I think we need in the industry. So.
Gotcha. And like any code, right, if you don't know who it came from, it's in, at least in this ecosystem, it's a safe bet to acknowledge like Kelsey for it. So that's awesome. Okay, so next question, right? We spoke about how we like capture data and do that load testing. How does this work with some PII information or information that might not be, like, I'm assuming this is all abstracted away, but just expand on that, how it works. Yeah.
So we have a built-in data loss prevention engine, or DLP. One of the most common questions we get after is this real? Does it actually work? Is, you know, how do you protect my data?
Yeah.
And so, in order to move into more sensitive environments, customers demanded really two things. The first one is the ability to redact and mask information upfront. And so we added that capability to our product to basically, when we see certain patterns of information, we say, no, you know, we're not going to send that along. And instead we replace it with something else that's safe. So that's that helps solve some of the classic problem of moving production data back to test environments. Now, I'm not going to pretend there's still a discipline around test data management that people pay tens of millions of dollars for. Mm-hmm. You know, there's very sophisticated solutions and some of our partners, you can use that, but we have a basic version of that. Now, the second thing that we do is we actually do data replacement in sort of an unusual way. So if you think about the way our system works, we're basically putting the service inside a sandwich of simulation, right? Mm-hmm. On one side of the sandwich is all these you know test cases that we're generating. The other half of the sandwich is are all these mocks that we're creating, and they have to agree with each other. Mm-hmm. So what we're getting smarter about this is we'll say if we see something in a test case coming in, like let's say it's like a social security number, then we see a subsequent call to a backend database with the same social security number. Not only will we mask it, but we'll say, hey, that's actually this social security number. Those two things need to be the same when we generate the mock as when we generate the load test. And so that keeps like data consistency.
Yeah, very important.
Yeah. And so where is all of this data stored, right? Like I know developers, when they are running their tests as part of the CI pipelines, get access to this, but is it stored in their own environments? Is this a SaaS-based service that you host the data for everyone?
So right now it's a SaaS-based solution that could be either multi-tenant if you want it cheaper, or it can be it can be single tenant if data privacy is very important to you. So that's how we run it right now. We have had requests to move it on like fully hosted by the customer in their VPC or whatever, and we're very open to that. But that obviously slows our velocity down. So we're kind of we haven't moved across that bridge yet. But we certainly understand that problem and have designed for it.
Got it. Makes sense. I want to come back real quick to some of the tools you mentioned SpeedScale working with. Now, you mentioned service meshes like Istio. What other tools in the Kubernetes ecosystem are commonly used with SpeedScale, or maybe you use them internally yourselves?
Yeah, good question. So one of the things very commonly used is Helm. When we first started, we try to make all the mistakes that are possible so that our customers don't have to.
Good.
So we've tested a bunch of different stuff and we find out what the market wants. So we kind of started out by having folks edit YAMLs. And of course that people hate editing YAMLs, it turns out. I love it so much. I thought everyone did. So Helm is very popular for us. Another one is obviously customization. Customize is very popular as well. And, I think those two kind of are, I don't want to say battling it out, but they're kind of for different use cases, but have a similar use case. Severity of the use case. So the other ones we run into are not necessarily a Kubernetes tool, but a technology, which is gRPC. Okay. Generally, if you're involved in this, we had to add gRPC support pretty early on. There's also some interesting stuff we're seeing, new kind of monitoring tools or monitoring technologies like OpenTelemetry, which is, I think, is an interesting development, obviously, as the libraries keep adding in monitoring support. Then I think you see things like eBPF or Pixie or ContainIQ. Yeah. And so we work pretty much with them. Shout out to our partners. We also work with Datadog and New Relic, Postman, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of those tools there, they're not Kubernetes specific. So
that's right. So talking about ContainIQ, right? Like that leads me into my next question. I was going through your website and looking at customer case studies to understand how customers are using your product. So I found ContainIQ as a customer case study in Nihilus, I think if I'm pronouncing it right, as a case study. If you can expand on how both of those customers are using SpeedScale and the value that they're getting out of it.
Yeah, so it's kind of two different takes on this, but they're representative of chunks of our customers. So Nihilus went through a transition from one cloud provider to another cloud provider, and part of what they needed to do was reduce cost, right, and make sure it was going to work properly, but also go to a new version of the technology that would and speed up the API performance. So I believe the exact numbers are Nihilus was able to improve their API performance by 30x. Through their own hard work using SpeedScale as well. they what they ended up doing is being able to have a hyper rapid development cycle by bringing back the mocks, essentially auto mocks. Their engineers were able to just test, and then load test like right on the fly and not have to wait for environments to be spun up or test cases to be written. So that helped them save, I think, quite a bit of money, being able to migrate to these new technologies. And then ContainIQ is representative of a more sort of traditional use of our product, which is also integrating us into CI, where you'll do things like every night, run a full battery of tests using SpeedScale.
Right.
And unlike, the integration or other testing approaches I talked about, you don't have to keep a giant environment stood up all the time. SpeedScale just goes, simulates a tiny little bit, runs the whole thing, and then, now you're good to go. And so, it really is, it's all about shipping faster and not having to do as many rollbacks. So,
yeah, always two good things to have. Makes sense. Now, you mentioned that SpeedScale is offered sort of as a SaaS service. Do you use any technologies, since this is, we often talk about data on Kubernetes, you are obviously dealing with lots of different types of data, depending on what those APIs are. Do you store that data in a specific database? Do you run it on Kubernetes? What does that sort of environment look like for you?
Yeah, so one of our core technologies is Timescale on Kubernetes. And so we run in cluster, and that is how we basically power our user interface. And so that UI, it's actually extremely fast for our use case. So we'll take, when you go and look at our traffic viewer, which is kind of like our monitoring tool, although we're not strictly a monitoring tool, but when you go look at all that data, you're actually looking at a Timescale interface.
Got it.
Where we're pulling up, gigs and gigs and gigs and gigs of whatever the most recent data is, and then slicing and dicing it and sorting it, producing aggregates, and then plugging that straight into our user interface. So that's one of the core technologies we use. We also use S3 in a more traditional sense. Uh-huh. Once data ages out, we send it to long-term storage and other things, whatever. We have people can use their own persistent volumes and other things to plug that in.
Absolutely. Gotcha. Now, do you have specific operators that run TimescaleDB? How much time and effort are you putting to running that thing on Kubernetes? Because we often hear different ways people are using data services on Kubernetes or choosing not to in some cases, or especially in sort of a SaaS environment in the cloud, you might use other types. I'm just curious about what's the day in and day out of managing a database on Kubernetes like, if you can comment on it.
Yeah, so Timescale, a database in Kubernetes are built on two very different principles. Database is all about persistence and Kubernetes is all about ephemeral. Right. So these have been some challenges for us over the year or the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But at this point, we don't do a lot of maintenance of Timescale from a manual perspective. We have nightly maintenance jobs that run and update our counters and do other kinds of cleanup tasks. Sure. But generally, Timescale is pretty reliable for us. We're also not storing stuff, eons in the past. Right. Mm-hmm. We have a high data volume, but it's relatively ephemeral. We store like whatever the latest amount of time is. So, I think we probably touch it, manually. We probably touch it a couple times a week. No, not even that much. Maybe once a week we do
that's
anything.
That's not too bad. Yeah.
No, it's not bad. It wasn't like that 2 years ago, but it's gotten a lot better, a lot better. So, yeah.
We like to hear that on this show. Absolutely. Yeah, we learned a lot about Timescale back in February, I believe it was.
Yes.
When we interviewed them. So, really interesting technologies. And honestly, fits your use case perfectly. So, good to hear.
Yep. So, talking about Timescale and how you can archive data for longer term storage, right? I know you said in the initial part that developers get like a 30 minute snapshot for their testing. Like you always have new data coming.
It's not set to 30 minutes, but it's whatever. Let's just say
X amount of time. Minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, how long do you have to keep the data for? Do you see customers asking for a load that like? Do you have to store those Black Friday load numbers so that they can test it against it this year? Or how does that work?
So we keep about 30 days of time, 30 days of data for most customers. So some customers just have too much data that, even the laws of physics become a problem at some point. But we tend to keep about 30 days worth of data instantly accessible on Timescale, just always ready to boogie. And we can basically rehydrate from S3 as necessary.
Okay.
So now the as far as developers, our policy is to hold data for 13 months. That's a policy that we've never enforced yet because we don't care. You know, it's not like it's super expensive to keep data around.
Yeah.
So we're not, so we never enforced it thus far, but it's about 13 months is what we say.
Thank you.
America, we are endowed by our creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Well, I think this is actually a good time to switch gears a little bit and ask our last question for today's interview, which is, if someone is listening to this podcast and is saying, wow, that timescale thing is really interesting and right up my alley, where do I get started and how do I get started? Where would you send them?
Yeah, so first thing is to sign up for a free trial. It takes, if you have a normal kind of workload, it takes about 10 minutes to get our stuff stood up. Now, if you want to do something, if you want us to unwrap TLS or do other things or do dated mutations, mm-hmm. which we can also do, then it can take a little bit longer. But just come sign up for a free trial. If you're not ready to sign up for a free trial, then come and join our community Slack. It's just slack.speedscale.com. And you can bother me pretty much anytime because I'm probably up all night anyway working on something. So we're always happy to talk to you.
Good. And you mentioned you're able to get started just on a developer laptop, right? You don't need anything too special.
No, actually, we have a tutorial that uses my favorite named demo app called Podtato Head.
Yeah. I have to look at that one now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's my favorite demo, but my favorite name for a demo app ever. Yeah. But, and it runs on Minikube on a developer desktop. And actually, our tutorial will walk you through as though you don't know anything about Kubernetes. And we'll walk, you know, you'll actually install Minikube, mm-hmm. install SpeedScale, and about 15 minutes later, you're going to be running.
Great. So. That sounds like a great place to start. Well, Matt, I know I've learned a lot about SpeedScale over the last 30 minutes or so, and I really appreciate you coming on the show. I think a lot of people will find this interesting and will, you know, love to have you back when there's other cool news.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Well, it was great having Matt on the show. I don't know about you, Bhavin, but I came into this show really naive about what SpeedScale was. I even think I mentioned to you, it was like, I didn't do enough to look into it and really understand it. But after the show and after talking to Matt, I really do understand it. I see the value in it. I think for me, what I got out of this was, right, automation, right? In a day where things are becoming more complex to do, you know, similar things and applications, like you said, are designed differently, right? Just the auto generation of these mocks and the data that's kept around for you in sort of the SaaS-based model. It definitely showcases where we're going as a market and where there's such value. You know, we often point at the end product in production. Mm-hmm. What's the business value? But this is really aimed at the development. And I think this is really exciting stuff.
Yeah. And like similar to you, right? I come from an operations background. So I do have a computer science major, but I've not like actually written any code in the past 5 to 6 years. Maybe that's, some people might be surprised with that, but so I did come into this conversation trying to learn more about how we are making lives easier for developers. So this was really cool that, given the new way that we are building these applications, everything has to be distributed. Everything has to follow that 12-factor best practices way of building apps. Having something that can test your APIs against actual production load is a really cool feature to have. Like it will definitely help customers move faster. And I think that's something that he highlighted from the customer case studies we discussed, right? Like it helped ContainIQ or Nihilist like move faster, iterate at a faster speed because they didn't have to worry about making sure whether they are testing it against enough load. I've personally seen examples where before anything goes GA, there needs to be like a 50 or 100 Kubernetes cluster deployed and tested out and making sure any product that goes GA is tested for load. So this makes it easy, makes it at the API level. So I've become a big fan, as you can clearly tell. And as Matt said, right, like it's really easy to get started. So why not like talk about how to do it?
Yeah. And going on that easy to get started, the fact that you could just, you know, boot it up on your laptop using something like Minikube. These days, I feel like that's so powerful, right? Especially from the developer mindset, right?
Yeah.
You really do want everything to be able to run on your laptop as much as possible. I mean, I know there's lots of services coming out that are, you know, virtual, and you can, you know, have entire IDEs and development environments sort of come to you, which is really cool. But still, this notion of being able to get started really quick is always exciting. Cool. So that was the end of the episode. Again, we'll, you know, drive home that, you know, whoever's listening, really go check out our other content or other episodes. Leave us a message. Leave us anything, positive, negative, what you'd like to hear, what topics you'd haven't heard yet that you really like to get a listen to. And please review us wherever you can on wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll have another episode in a couple weeks. And that brings us to the end of today's episode. I'm Ryan.
I'm Robin.
And thanks for joining another episode of Kubernetes Bytes. Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.